Today's Science Friday podcast sponsor is O'Reilly Media with Learning Paths Video Training, your most direct route to learning a new skill or technology, from big data to programming languages to UX design. Find your path today. O'Reilly.com/go/SciFry.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. President Obama wrapped up a trip to the Arctic Circle this week. He was in Alaska for a conference to discuss global priorities in the area and also to witness firsthand the impact of climate change on the region. In his speech at the conference, the president had strong words for climate change deniers.
So the time to heed the critics and the cynics and the deniers is past. The time to plead ignorance is surely past. Those who want to ignore the science, they are increasingly alone. They're on their own shrinking island.
The president has addressed climate change with increasing forcefulness throughout his second term. Was this speech any different? Here to tell us about that and other selected short subjects in science is Brooke Burrell. She writes the blog Our Modern Plagues and is a contributing editor at Popular Science here in New York City. Welcome back, Brooke.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think was the significance of President Obama talking about climate change in the Arctic right now?
Well, as far as he being in the Arctic is very sensitive to climate change, sort of the canary in the coal mine as far as that goes. It's also a beautiful backdrop for these speeches, right? He's eating salmon jerky, he's hanging out with some fishermen. But as far as what the content of his speech actually was, there wasn't a lot new here. There weren't any policy changes. It was really more of a legacy speech, I think. He's not going to be in office that much longer. This is sort of him making this. It was a great speech. You know, it was really fiery. Like the New York Times called it, they said it bordered on the apocalyptic, which I thought was fitting. You know, he's talking about the science of Stark. It's happening here. It's happening now. We're not acting fast enough. But there wasn't a lot new in what he was saying.
A lot of environmentalists noted that he didn't really focus on oil drilling there, which his administration recently approved, though.
Yeah, right. He mostly, when he was talking about energy and that kind of stuff, he was sort of promoting the things that his that he's done as far as renewables and stuff, but he certainly didn't mention the offshore drilling by Royal Dutch Shell.
You put out a story this week about pesticides and marijuana. What did you find?
Yeah, so this is a situation that's been going on for a while. It's getting worse and worse just because we have more states that are legalizing marijuana, and it's just sort of an unprecedented situation as far as agriculture goes in the United States. So just like any other crop, marijuana needs, it gets pests, right? So you have to deal with stuff like spider mites and aphids and powdery mildew. These are the kind of pests that marijuana plants get. And usually a farmer, a grower, would be able to use pesticides or other options to be able to combat those. But the way that pesticides are actually regulated in the United States is at the federal level. So the EPA takes data and stuff like that, toxicity profiles from the companies. They come up with a label. That's the actual label that goes on the bottle. That's actually a legally binding document. That's, a lot of people don't realize that. That's basically a contract saying what you can use it on, where you can use it, under what conditions. And nothing like that exists for marijuana because, as we know, it's a Schedule I narcotic. So the people that are actually growing this crop in these states where it's legal are kind of in a bind because they don't have anything they're legally allowed to use. The states are having to come up with lists of things. Well, you can probably use these, but most of those items on those lists are sort of these generally recognized as safe ingredients. They don't necessarily work that well. So now you have people using, and there's evidence of this. The Oregonian actually did a really great investigative report a little bit earlier this summer, and I've read some white papers on the same thing. They have companies going in, taking residues off of products that are already on the shelves and finding kind of shockingly high materials and materials that shouldn't be used on food in general. They're getting even more concentrated in the oil concentrates because as you concentrate THC, which is the goal there, you're often also concentrating the pesticides.
Yes.
So there are some cases where, you know, we're talking hundreds of parts per million in those concentrates of traces of pesticides where, you know, it's a few parts per million allowed on food crops. So it's a pretty significant difference.
And is the EPA going to do anything? I mean, what can they do as long as the federal government doesn't weigh in?
It's tough, too. Yeah, and there's also not really any research on the health issue of this because the schools that would be doing a lot of the research, they are afraid of jeopardizing their federal funding. The EPA did decide that the states could apply for these things called special local needs applications where they basically, the state will come and say, hey, we need to use this thing. Here's some data that's, you know, we think supports that we can use this thing safely, and the EPA can say yes or no. But the companies that actually make the products have to be on board, And I don't think it's very likely that they're going to want to promote their products in this way. So we'll see how that works out.
Interesting. So now next up, you brought us a story that there's a study that looked at how birds were affected by traffic noise.
Yeah, I didn't actually write about this one. This was at The Atlantic with their new science writer, Ed Young, but it was really interesting. So there's been a lot of research on just pollution around, you know, traffic and that kind of thing on wildlife. But usually noise pollution isn't separated from exhaust and from all other things that are going to go along with a road being there, right? So these scientists basically built a phantom road in the middle of the woods by just hanging these large loudspeakers and playing the sounds you would hear on a roadway, but without everything else. And then they set up these nets and collected birds, and they did a similar thing without the noise a few miles away. And they're counting how many birds were passing through. They're measuring their weight and these kinds of things to see whether that sound was affecting them. And they did find that there were far fewer birds. I think it was a third fewer birds actually in the area with the noise. And they also were lighter. They weren't eating as much, apparently. The researchers then did some tests in the lab, and they think that maybe the sounds were distracting them from looking for food because there was plenty of food in their area. There was nothing else they could sort of figure out as to why they were losing weight. Might have been other reasons.
The birds just didn't like the sounds, and all of a sudden they're not eating, and they're out of there. Okay, so we're going to finish with a quirky story you wrote about, and you write about plagues, and this is interesting. The big Burning Man festival started this week, and there's a bug infestation at Burning Man?
Yeah. Apparently it's cleared up by now, but when before the burners actually arrived at Burning Man out in the desert. Yeah, that's what they're called. The organizers were just plagued by these insects, or so they said. They went to on social media blogs, they're showing images of these insects. Entomologists were going online and looking at the pictures and trying to figure out what these were. One entomologist actually that I interviewed, she said that normally you can't tell species level from photos because you usually have to actually look a lot closer than those allow. But they were able to figure out that these were some sort of stink bugs and seed bugs. But these feed on plants. So these were showing up probably, the theory goes, that there's more vegetation in the area because of extra rain, and the insects are showing up to eat the plants, not to bug the people. They didn't know they were going to run into people
because
out in the
they think
of the
it's
desert.
All about them,
yeah,
right? The bugs
absolutely.
Are coming to ruin our time.
Yeah.
But one of the things you concentrated on is the sense that the media covers it like these bugs are so gross that the bugs are just doing bug stuff.
They're
right?
doing bug stuff. And I have a soft spot for bugs, as people may know. But yeah, the press was calling them disgusting, grotesque, super gross was another term that was thrown around. And these are harmless bugs. They're not biting people intentionally. They're not sucking your blood. They're not spreading disease. That same entomologist that I interviewed pointed out that if this had been sort of a socially accepted insect like a butterfly, it would have been we wouldn't have been saying plague. We would have been saying, what a miracle that nature has brought.
Well, they are stink bugs. They're a little stinky, right?
Yeah, they're annoying, but yeah, they're okay.
All right. Brooke Burrell writes the blog Our Modern Plague. She's a contributing editor at Popular Science here in New York. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Next up, it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Big data is big business these days. Whenever you log online or swipe your credit card, your data is being collected, sorted, and then sold. One burgeoning scene of big data collection is the classroom. Learning apps are starting to collect data about students and their habits. My next guest is here to tell us the good and the bad of collecting student data from these apps. Natasha Singer is a technology reporter for the New York Times business section. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so what's the good thing about collecting this data through learning apps?
Well, first of all, it's an emerging field, so these are hypothetical good things. But the idea is that if you collect information about what students like, that you can customize what they see and hopefully have them more engaged in learning and have better outcomes. So if you're a student who's into music or sports, and this learning app can algorithmically show you math problems that are sports-based or music-based, maybe you'll spend more time doing these problems, maybe you'll do better at them, maybe you'll have better test scores, maybe you'll have better grades. Another idea is not just the customization by subject, but that more sophisticated kind of apps with artificial intelligence will be able to figure out, wow, this student really understands multiplication, both 4 times 4 and 12 times 12, and so we're going to give this student harder problems automatically, algorithmically, and send them on to long division. But the algorithm notices that some other student sitting next to them is having trouble. They get the 4 times 4, but not the 12 times 12, and then is going to automatically show them problems to help them master that. And so the idea is by acknowledging that every student is different and having these digitized apps that collect data about every single keystroke and every hesitation and analyze all those things, that theoretically, by differentiating, those students will have material that will advance them when they're ready to advance, so they won't be bored, and help them and have the teacher intervene when they're frustrated so that they won't give up.
Okay, so personalized learning, that's a good thing. What's the bad thing?
Again, hypothetically, there are a lot of things, right? One of which is that just by showing kids what they're interested in, you know, if you're into sports and I'm going to give you vocabulary games about sports, just because you're spending more time in it doesn't mean you're going to do better. So one of the big questions is this actually going to improve education? And the second question is, you know, whenever we treat people differently, and we're, talking about a protected category like students, the concern is if you've got some computer algorithm that's making judgments, are they going to automatically make judgments that could be detrimental to a certain group of students? And we've seen that in the consumer side, where in the consumer world, you know, some stores automatically charge online shoppers more if they geographically are located further or closer to the store, or they show people more expensive hotels if they use an iPad or an iPhone as opposed to an IBM device. And so we see this kind of price discrimination happening in the consumer world, and the concern is, are we going to see educational discrimination happening by algorithm, not because it's intended, but just because, you know, an unintended consequence of the way the app is designed.
Yeah, and things like collecting weight or body mass index information, things that could really embarrass or traumatize kids.
Well, that's another potential harm, which is just the actual collection and surveillance of data potentially harmful? And I wrote a story about this recently because there are programs in 25 states to collect children's weight and body mass and then send letters home to certain parents saying, hey, your kid is obese or at risk of obesity. And when I talked to some moms about this whose kids had gotten these letters, it turned out that they were weighed in public and their weight was shouted out and kids made fun of each other. And then when these letters, which have been nicknamed the fat letters, were delivered, it was in class with the words overweight, marked on the letters. And so you're causing trauma in the collection. And then scientists studied this and determined that the kids who were in these obesity intervention programs didn't do any better than kids who weren't tracked.
And that Natasha, I've got to let you go there, but that doesn't sound very good at all. Okay, so there's a bad thing. Natasha Singer, technology reporter for the New York Times, thanks so much for joining us. After the break, a new cure for colorblindness in monkeys and our tribute to Oliver Sacks. Stay with us.
Support for the Science Friday podcast comes from Audible. Do you love books but find that you never have time to read them? Well, audible.com has the perfect solution. Get audiobooks and listen while on the go. Audible.com provides over 180,000 titles from the leading publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazines and newspapers, and business information providers. Their app is free and it works on iPhones, iPad, Android, and Windows Phone. You can also download and listen on your Kindle Fire and over 500 MP3 players. And with Audible, you own the books, so you can access them anytime and anywhere right from your smartphone. Audible.com also has the Great Listen Guarantee. If you decide you don't like the book you chose, you can exchange it for another title anytime, no questions asked. And for Science Friday listeners, Audible.com is offering a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Friday today to start your free trial.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. That sound means it's time to talk about our new macroscope video. It's up now at sciencefriday.com. Video producer Luke Groskin joins me in the studio to talk about it. Luke, what is under the macroscope this week?
Well, this week we're looking at a subject that's quite near and dear to my own heart. Colorblindness. Our new video looks at the work of two visionary researchers, Dr. J. and Maureen Knights, who have successfully cured colorblindness in two squirrel monkeys.
Ah, okay, so this is personal to you. Why is this personal?
Well, I myself am colorblind.
Uh-huh.
And what that means is I don't see the world in black and white like a lot of people think. Most people, 99% of all people that are colorblind, have red-green colorblindness. And what that means is I see red and green differently from the way a normal visioned person actually sees it. So, for example, if I go and I'm walking out in autumn and I'm looking at those beautiful fall leaves, well, they're kind of boring to me. They don't really look that much different than they used to look. Or if I go out shopping, I buy a lot of blurple clothes, which are clothes that could be blue or purple.
Blurple.
Yeah, I have no idea what color they are. It also means that, I can't join the Air Force. I can't be a pilot because I have to be able to see those lights at the end of the runway, or I have to be able to see certain colors in a Army setting or something like that. And it also means I would have a lot of difficulty being a nurse. I can't see certain pills. I couldn't tell if a patient is in trouble. I can't go up to a doctor and say, doctor, he's turning blurple.
That doesn't work. So what causes colorblindness? It's genetic, right?
Yes, it's totally genetic. It's not something that you can catch. About 8 to 10% of men have it, and about 1 in 200 women have it. Now, what's really going on is that there's a faulty gene on my X chromosome, which causes the red and green cones in my eyes to lack a pigment or have a skewed pigment so that when the light comes into my eye, I don't pick up on it. And that in and of itself can change drastically how I view the world. And because it's on the X chromosome and women have two X chromosomes, there's far less likely that they'll get two faulty genes. And so the one gene kind of covers for the other one.
Ah, okay. So you talked about this potential cure for colorblindness. Tell us a bit more about this.
This is the work of two decades of research by J. and Maureen Knights, who are a neurobiologist and a geneticist. And, they've been working on this for a really, really long time. And they realized that squirrel monkeys, male squirrel monkeys specifically, have red colorblindness. Now, females don't have any sort of colorblindness whatsoever. And so what they did is they injected the red color pigment gene into a virus, and then they put those viruses into the retina of these monkeys, and it cured their colorblindness.
Wow. You've got some great footage of the monkeys taking a color vision test. Can you explain what they're doing in this video?
Oh, it's really, really cute. So before they gave them gene therapy, they're looking at a screen, and they see a yellow blob on the screen, and they smush their faces against the yellow blob, and when they do that correctly, they get a little treat. They get a little sugar snack. So after the gene therapy, they're doing the same thing now with red blobs. So they know that they're able to, take the test properly. And they also gave this test, by the way, to other monkeys that didn't have the therapy, and they still failed the test when they see the red blobs. So they know for a fact that these viruses had changed the genes inside these monkeys' eyes.
You got to watch the video just to watch the monkeys smush their faces. So, okay, could this work in humans, do you think?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It should hypothetically work in humans. So they have the gene that for humans. They have the virus. They're ready to go. They're just waiting for the FDA to prove it. And conceptually speaking, we should be able to have these sort of perceptions, this change in perceptions. It should work because the monkeys, it worked on monkeys.
So this is something you're looking forward to, especially because you're a videographer. You make videos. You've got to deal with colors all the time. Was this video hard to make for you?
This is one of the more difficult videos I've ever had to make. I have many late nights frustrated, staring at a screen going, I think the apple's red. It could be red. A lot of turning to my coworkers being like, okay, can you tell me, am I showing this? Is this right? Is this dark green or is this light green? It was a little really frustrating.
Okay, so maybe there's some hope. Luke Roskin is Science Friday's video producer. You can check out our macroscope video, A Cure for the Colorblindness Blues, at sciencefriday.com. Thanks so much, Luke.
Thank you.
For the rest of this hour, we're paying tribute to Oliver Sacks, who passed away last Sunday. Sacks was a man who wore many, many hats, most famously as a neurologist and a writer, but he was also a motorcycle racer, a weightlifter, and a swimmer. He was an amateur naturalist, too, fascinated by ferns, cycads, cephalopods, and minerals. In our increasingly specialized world, it's hard to find people who truly embody the Renaissance ideal, but Dr. Sachs did, without a doubt. Last year, when I interviewed him in this studio, he stayed behind after his segment had ended. I noticed him sitting across from me. He was furiously writing notes about our next topic. I realized that we probably could have asked Oliver Sachs about, well, just about anything. He was endlessly curious about the outer world and about the inner world of our brains and its many fascinating variations and disorders. He inspired countless patients, readers, colleagues, and friends. So today we've gathered a few of those friends and also some clips of Oliver himself from the Science Friday archives to celebrate a life well lived. Joining me now is one of Oliver's colleagues and friends, Eric Kandel. He's a university professor and Copley professor at Columbia University here in New York, co-director of the Zuckerman Mind-Brain Behavior Initiative, and senior investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Kandel.
Thank you, John. Delighted to be here.
Eric, first of all, what was Oliver's greatest gift in your mind?
Oliver's greatest gift was he was a great neurologist. But that would not distinguish him from many other great neurologists. What was extraordinary about Oliver, he was the greatest storyteller neurology ever had. Mm. Now, neurology has had many important contributions. In the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s, different functions of the brain were localized to different regions of the cerebral cortex. For example, in 1861, Paul Broca discovered there's an area in the brain that is involved in the articulation of language. A decade later, Carl Wernicke described an area involved in the comprehension of language, and Wernicke developed a whole theory about how we listen to language and articulate language, a whole theory of speech. But this affected a limited number of people who were working on the brain. What Oliver was able to do is to speak to everyone, to be able to take these clinical stories, these clinical anecdotes, and bring out the magic in them. Isn't it wonderful to be able to localize functions in the brain? Imagine the mental function in the brain. There's no dualism. The mind is a set of functions carried out by the brain. This is the way he would have told the Broca-Wernicke story. And he did this time and time again. Take his first great book, Awakenings, and his first great clinical contribution. He was working in the Beth Israel Hospital in 1970, and he found a group of people in that hospital who were survivors of the epidemic of sleeping sickness, which broke out after the First World War, 1918 to about 1922. Many of these people had not been out of bed for decades. Now, as he began to look into the clinical history of these people, he realized that many of these people suffered from a late form of Parkinson's disease, and that this sleeping illness was a manifestation of late-stage Parkinson's disease. Well, it turned out at the time he was seeing them in the 1970s, a treatment had just emerged, L-DOPA, for Parkinson's disease. And he had the idea, despite the fact that these people had been sleeping for several decades, maybe they would respond to L-DOPA. And he put them on L-DOPA, and lo and behold, people that had not been out of bed for decades began to get out of bed.
I wanted to say, and we're talking today with friends and colleagues of Oliver Sachs as we pay tribute to his life, and we'll also give you a chance to call in at 844-724-8255. That's 844-PSY-TALK. Orrin Devinsky, a professor of neurology at the NYU School of Medicine, was a friend and colleague of Oliver's for over 25 years. He had this to say about how Oliver Sachs approached his patients.
Oliver brought two things together that, to my view of the history of medicine, were really never brought together. One was the very meticulous interest and study of individual patients. And the second was a humanity and a humility in approaching those patients. So that whereas people 50 and 70 and 90 years ago certainly did meticulous case studies, they didn't have the humanity. And nowadays, in many, certainly in academic medicine, neither case studies nor humanity is a prominent area.
Eric Kandel, what Oliver was practicing seems like personalized medicine before that became a buzzword.
You're absolutely right. And what we just heard was absolutely true. But that would not have made him Oliver Sacks. What made him Oliver Sacks is he could take his humanity, he could take his insight, he could take his careful examination of the patient and describe it for the general reader in a way that was absolutely fascinating and got people interested in a mind who previously had no concern with it at all. Moreover, he was able to show that being abnormal doesn't mean necessarily that you're bad or necessarily that you should be rejected, that abnormalities often bring out other aspects of character. They strengthen or they allow the emergence of features of your life that you were not aware of and that other people were not aware of. So certain aspects of creativity emerge in the presence of certain kinds of illnesses.
I'd like to bring on another guest now, another friend of Oliver's, whom you may have read about in his article, Stereo Sue, or in the book, The Mind's Eye. Sue Berry is a professor of biological sciences at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. She joins us here today in our Science Friday studios. Welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here.
How did you get to know Oliver Sacks?
So I got to know Oliver Sacks because of my vision. Basically, I've been cross-eyed since infancy or even perhaps at birth. And as a result of that, my vision didn't develop normally. I didn't use my two eyes together. And so my view of the world was one of lower resolution and was flatter. Space was compressed. And I did have three surgeries as a kid, but they didn't really change my vision. They just made my eyes look straighter. And so in 1996, I happened to meet Oliver at a party. And I, being the neurologist he is, but more than that, being the totally observant person that he was, he, I could tell, noticed that my eyes were still crossed. And so I started to blurt out to him, you know, I am cross-eyed. I think I see the world a little differently than other people. And he asked me a question. Do you think you can imagine what it's like to see with two eyes? And at the time, I said, oh, yeah, I think I can do it. I'm a college professor. I teach about stereo vision in class. I think I know what I'm missing. And he said, he didn't say anything, really, just nodded his head. Well, about 8 years later, 9 years later, well, actually, in 2002, I went to see a developmental optometrist. And I went through a program of vision therapy, and I learned to see with two eyes, and I developed stereo vision. And the change in my vision was remarkable. And for about 2 years, I didn't write it. I didn't tell anybody about it outside family and friends because I was afraid that they would think I was delusional because there was a theory, a dogma, that there was a critical period in early childhood for the development of 3D vision. And since I didn't develop it then, I could never develop it. It was impossible. The brain just wasn't that flexible. And I was also afraid people would tell me it wasn't a big deal. And yet I found the change in my vision to be remarkable and incredibly joyful. And so one day, about 2 or 3 years after my vision began to change, I just sat down, and what burst out of me was a 9.5-page shingle-space letter to Oliver Sacks. And I said, Dear Dr. Sacks, you asked me this question, could I imagine seeing with two eyes? 9 years ago, you asked me this question. I said I could, and I was completely wrong. And then I went on and told him my story. And he wrote back right away saying he wanted to come visit. And he visited, we talked, he wrote to other scientists, he wrote Stereo Sue, and since that time, we actually have exchanged 130 letters together.
130 letters.
Yeah, I'll treasure them always.
I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And Sue, one of the other things, too, that he asked you about was how you felt about this.
Absolutely.
And that's so important. It's so much a part, as Eric Kandel was saying, of the Oliver Sacks story.
Right. I've had my vision actually tested by quite a number of scientists who have been intrigued by my story. And they're all been very polite, and they're all very interested in what mechanism might explain my story and so on. But it was only... Because of the way, although they were all very polite, I always felt a little bit like a laboratory rat or an oddity, an oddball of sorts. And the only person who ever studied my vision that I didn't feel that way about was Oliver Sacks. He really seemed to want to understand how it was that I now saw the world through my eyes. What was different? What was confusing? What was joyous about it? It was like we were sharing a dialogue. He never patronized. He never objectified. I was so glad that he was the first person outside of friends and family I told my story to.
Go ahead, Eric, please.
Sue makes a very beautiful point about Oliver. First of all, his enormous curiosity, but also his empathy. And what he made absolutely clear to many people whom he knew was that he was in psychoanalysis. He was in psychoanalysis for over 40 years with the same person. And he brought to bear on his patients the same thoughtfulness, the person as an individual, not as a case study, that is characteristic of an analytic approach to the patient. So he introduced psychoanalytic thinking, if you will, into neurology.
You actually interviewed, Eric, a patient with Oliver at one time.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Could you tell us that quickly?
Well, when he was doing musical hallucinations, I heard about a woman who wanted to see me who had musical hallucinations, and I thought that I asked the permission to have Oliver come along, and we both interviewed her. But what was interesting about her, and Oliver had described this in other contexts, is I'm a psychiatrist, and I've seen a number of psychotic patients with hallucinations, and the hallucinations are very frightening. They're usually sort of superego phenomenon. You're a bad boy. You're doing the wrong thing, some punitive kind of thing. But this woman was not psychotic, and these were really egocentric. They were pleasurable to her. She heard religious songs. She heard things that were very marvelous for her. And it was just wonderful to sit with her and see under what circumstances these came out and how she responded to them. And Oliver and I took very different approaches, and we enjoyed it a great deal.
And we're talking with Eric Kandel and also Sue Berry, two friends and colleagues of the great Oliver Sacks. And when we come back from our break, our celebration of the life of Oliver Sacks continues, and we'll also hear from the man himself. I hope you can stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. We're paying tribute to Oliver Sacks this hour with recollections from friends and colleagues, like my guests, Eric Kandel, who's a university professor and Kavli professor at Columbia University. He's also co-director of the Zuckerman Mind-Brain-Behavior Initiative. Sue Berry is a professor of biological sciences at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. Oliver Sacks, of course, was fascinated by cephalopods. He had them on his stationery, his website, and his shirts. I'd like to play a clip now from December of 2005 in which he talks about that love.
Last time you came on the program, you were wearing a squid t-shirt. You got your squid welcome squid overlords on it. When did you get so interested in squid?
I think probably when I was a boy, the Natural History Museum in London had a model of a giant squid, and it was such an amazing, improbable life form that I was fascinated by it and still am. And I've of course, everyone is fascinated by giant squids. It's sort of like dinosaurs. and it's very exciting that a living one has been filmed for the first time this year.
Yeah. Would you love to go out and actually search for one with the scientists who go out there?
I think so, in a relatively safe sort of submersible. Although in general, with a single exception, sort of squids are not too aggressive, at least to human beings.
Right.
The exception is a squid called Humboldt squid in the Gulf of Mexico, which is a very muscular, aggressive 200-pound squid. And that I prefer to see at a distance.
Okay, well.
That's Oliver Sacks talking to Ira Flato back in December of 2005. I'd like to bring on another friend of Oliver's, someone who would probably agree with the slogan on Oliver's shirt, Welcome Squid Overlords. Roger Hanlon is a senior scientist at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you, John. Good to be here.
You came to meet Oliver Sacks in a kind of unusual way, didn't you?
I did indeed. I read about Oliver in a Airplane magazine, and I read this phrase by someone saying, someone should play symphonic music to a cuttlefish. And I thought, wow, and there's a broad-thinking character. I then got in touch with him, and to make a long story short, he visited my laboratory several times in Woods Hole and would just sit for hours on end watching our amazing cuttlefish and squid and octopus behave.
And did you ever follow through on that idea?
Well, we followed up on a lot of ideas. One of the great things about Oliver is he was always planting new ideas into your mind. He had such a different way of thinking about sensory function and behavior in complex brains. And we did eventually play music to squids, for example, but they can't hear symphonic music that well because they're tuned into low-frequency sounds, but they sure like rap, and they can actually hear that quite well. I think Oliver was a little amazed when he heard that.
That's funny. Eric Kandel, did Oliver's love of the sea extend to your model organism of choice, the sea slug?
Yes. He actually had an essay about a squid cuttlefish in which he had a discussion of aplysia as well. And I wanted me to show him an aplysia, and I did, and some of the reflexes that aplysia shows. He was really quite fascinated by it. He had a remarkable range of interest as has emerged in this program. The other thing which was not apparent to me, because Oliver had a number of incapacities. For example, he wrote this wonderful book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, that is a person who suffered from prosop agnosia, face blindness. Oliver himself was face blind. I also have the feeling that Oliver was space blind. He had a difficult time finding his way around environments. So how he would handle a major illness for somebody who was so dependent wasn't at all clear to me. But I think one of the most remarkable things about Oliver's life was the last 8 months, you know, when he first wrote this essay in the New York Times indicating that a tumor that he had in the eye, which was removed and everyone thought completely gone, had in fact metastasized to the liver, and that at the time that he wrote this, 90% of the liver was gone, and he knew he had a limited amount of time to live. And he faced this so bravely. He published another book, On the Move, in which he described for the first time his extraordinary athletic past, his weightlifting, his relationship with Billy Hayes. He spoke openly about the fact that he was a gay person, which he had not done before, and really opened himself up to so many things in a very positive way. And I think one of the most moving things he has ever written in his life is the essay that he wrote on the Sabbath, sort of a week before he died, in which he pointed out that in the Jewish religion from which he came, one would celebrate the Sabbath, a day of rest. After a well-earned week of hard work, you deserve a rest. And he said, and this is the way I feel about life. I've had 82 years. They've been wonderful years. I've enjoyed them. I think I've done some good. There's no reason, you know, why it should not come to an end. I'm perfectly comfortable with the end. Hmm. So rather, unlike Dylan Thomas, who said, do not go gently into that sweet night, you know, rage into the dimming of the light. He said, look, this is inevitable, and I've been so privileged, I go completely comfortable into that good night. I think that was fantastic.
It's so interesting, too, because you talk about him being a great athlete, which people who knew him knew quite well. He would say that near the end of his life, he walked with a bit of a limp, but he was still a very, very strong swimmer, something he did all the time. And Sue,
yes,
Barry,
great swimmer.
Well, and Sue, I want to ask you about this. He visited you once at Woods Hole, and you took a very special swim. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, sure. We did quite a number of swims together. The special swim that you're referring to was to see the Noctiluca scintillans, which is a kind of bioluminescent microorganism that invades the waters of Woods Hole in August. And he was out in August, and we went to the beach. And actually, when we were at the beach, there were some guards there. And we told the guards, oh, we're doing some scientific research. And they let us stay, and we went into the water. It was nighttime. And as you swam about and disturbed the organisms, they would sparkle. And so our whole bodies would sparkle. And Oliver loved it. He just loved it.
Now, he also had a fascination with plants, among them cycads. He told us about an experiment that he commissioned to send cycads to space back in March of 1997.
What would you like to study now, if you could study it?
Well, one of my interests is space.
You told me. Yeah, you came in wearing this jacket with all these space the patches from all these shuttle launches. You said one of the seeds were what? Tell us about it.
One of my good friends, Marsha Ivans, is an astronaut. She's sort of been up four times in the shuttle. Mm-hmm. I was down in Cape Canaveral for her last sort of launch and landing. And since I love cycads, I asked if it might be possible to give some seeds a ride. And so in the last shuttle, which went up to the Hubble, some cycad seeds were taken up there. And I think I'm due to get the full story this weekend. I think one or two of them may have germinated in space.
Is that right?
So I like to think that these cycads, as well as having sort of floated over ocean currents to all the islands of the Pacific, or many of them, you know, may also have had a little taste of space.
We have to watch how they grow. I mean, if they germinated in space, you know, who knows what could happen.
Right.
Were they unofficial cargo?
Very unofficial, and maybe I shouldn't have mentioned this.
We won't tell anybody.
We won't tell anybody. It's just between us.
It's between us.
All right.
That's a great little moment with Ira and with Oliver Sacks as we celebrate his great life. Roger Hanlon, this is one of the things that was so remarkable about him. He was interested in so many things and so intensely observant. He carried a magnifying glass with him on walks. He was always trying to learn about things.
There's no doubt about it. He had a curiosity that few of us are able to enjoy, and he would check everything out, and nothing was beyond his visual grasp. I'd like to point out that one of the great attributes of him was his interest in sensory perception, no matter what system it was. For example, he wrote the book Island of the Colorblind, and the animals we work on, and this is one of his interests in the cephalopods, is that our cephalopods are colorblind, but they achieve beautifully color-coordinated camouflage. And this really vexed him, as it does us, and it opened up an interesting dialogue about visual perception. And so he was a very broad thinker. He would think of cephalopods along with humans and how sensory systems work. And so I really think that it was so endearing to be near him, because he'd come up with these very unusual ways of looking at a problem that we look at every day. So he had a real genius for that.
I want to go to the phones. Harvey is calling from Fresno, California. Hello, Harvey. You're on Science Friday.
Hi there.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Well, I'd like to tell you a story. I'm a fellow in the American Academy of Neurology, and I trained at UCLA, where Oliver did a fellowship. And there's a legend that was told to me by Dick Walter, who is a former chairman of the neurology department at UCLA, about Oliver doing visual fields on a patient with a pituitary tumor. The patient actually began to herniate. The tumor began pressing on the brainstem during the visual field. And Oliver, who had been a collegiate wrestler, grabbed the woman by the legs, held her upside down, walked by the neurosurgery unit to get the neurosurgical resident, and walked her down to the operating room where she underwent a decompression and saved her life.
Mm. That's an amazing story. And Sue Berry is sitting across from me going, that's a true story. This is a story you know, Sue.
I have heard this story before, both from Oliver and others, yes.
My goodness. Thank you very much for sharing that, Harvey. I really appreciate it. Do you think, Sue, that in some way he identified with his patients in a way that others just couldn't?
Absolutely. I think he did. I think he always probably felt a little bit like an outlier, and thereby that might have promoted his sense of identifying with his patients more than perhaps any others. And he really... he always tried to see things through their perspective. When I talked to him, I really got that impression. He was intensely focused on our conversation, and I got the impression he was trying to see the world through my eyes.
Hmm. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. As we wrap up our conversation today, I want to go back to a clip from December of 2005 in which Ira asked Oliver the blank check question. What would he want to discover or accomplish if he had all the resources in the world?
Although I think it's impossible, I sometimes long for something like telepathy, to know how it is for other people, and also to know how it is for other animals. How is it for a squid, you know, for such an alien intelligence? I think basically I'm a sort of naturalist and an explorer, and I would just want to see more of the human and animal and plant and mineral diversity of the world. And why stop at this world? I would like to see Titan. I would like to see an extrasolar planet, and so forth.
So little time, so much to do. Right, is what you're saying. If you had to start life again, you'd be doing the same thing. Would you try something else?
I suspect it might be something similar.
Yeah. Is it that you can't meet enough people because of just the number of hours in the day or the time that you can get to see them?
I think it's basically that. But there is a sort of reaching out. For example, when I wrote something on musical hallucinations, then I've had literally hundreds of correspondents, and I've met a lot of them, and that's been a delight to me, and clarified things may be helpful to them. So I just want to reach out to the world's diversity. I'm a describer. I am an explorer. I don't know how much of a theorizer or an explainer I am, but I think to tell accurate stories is crucial.
Candela, I'd like you to give us a thought on that to close, the idea of telling accurate stories and how crucial it is and how great a storyteller Oliver Sacks was.
I think that's absolutely right, and that's really among the many remarkable features that he has, his ability to tell a brilliant story. Sort of the Shakespeare of neurology is extraordinary. And he's manifested itself in so many different ways in his writings and his interactions with people. I mean, Sue could make this point. He had extensive correspondence. As far as I could tell, every one of those letters was handwritten. So there was a personal touch to everything that you got from Oliver. Yeah. He was a remarkable human being. And I come back to the way he died. He taught us all how to confront death as a natural phenomenon in life, to enjoy life to the full, and then to be able to enjoy the fact that it's coming to an end.
Sue, do you have a last thought on that?
I guess my last thought would be that now that we're entering a post-Oliver world, we should all, as much as possible, try to emulate many of the things he did. Tell good stories, be a real passionate and empathic human being, and also don't take life too seriously.
Roger Handlin, we just have a minute left, but I'd love to hear your final thoughts.
Yes, he wrote to me and said after he wrote Hallucinations, he'd been thinking about the cognitive skills, intelligence, and awareness in invertebrates. And he says the cuttlefish and octopus seem the most neurally endowed to develop these attributes. He says, do they have hallucinations or do they dream or sleep? One would think that those billions of neurons need a break somehow. So this is thinking differently, but how do brains work is what he was after. I consider him a Renaissance model, physician, musician, athlete, thinker, naturalist, and a very gifted writer with an elegant, endearing style.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for sharing some of your thoughts about Oliver Sacks. I was very pleased to get a chance to interview him just once in this chair, and it's something that I will always remember. I want to thank Roger Handlin, a senior scientist at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Thank you so much, sir.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks also to Eric Kandel, University Professor and Kavli Professor at Columbia University and co-director of the Zuckerman Mind-Brain-Behavior Initiative. Thank you so much, Eric Kandel.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And Sue Barry is a professor of biological sciences at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts, who joined us in our studios in New York today. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, John.
Charles Bergquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our Sci-Arts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Our production assistant is Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director, and Sarah Fishman is our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Plus, when it comes to women's health, Sharon Hillier knows a thing or two. She studies microbicides, compounds designed to prevent infection in women. Read her story at sciencefriday.com/HIV. You can send us emails at scifry@sciencefriday.com.